We've all seen Peter O'Toole in Lawrence of Arabia, but who was T.E. Lawrence really? Scott Anderson, author of a new biography, Lawrence in Arabia, will tell us.
Everybody who knew Lawrence talked about that there's a kind of a funny streak of effeminacy about him. He had this high girlish laugh and kind of a funny way of running.
Brenda Wineapple's new history of Civil War era America takes its title from an Emily Dickinson poem. She'll be here to talk about that book, Ecstatic Nation.
Much about this period is known. So if I'm going to, for example, talk about Bull Run, I want to talk about the journalists who covered it. So we know how we got that information.
Every parent knows the mark of a good picture book is the gold Caldecott seal. But who was Randolph Caldecott? Children's book historian Leonard Marcus will talk about the man behind the medal. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Scott Anderson is the author of Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. And he joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Pamela.
Thanks for coming in. How did you decide to take on this huge mythic figure of T. Lawrence? Obviously, not someone who has never been written about.
Oh, I've always been fascinated by T. Lawrence. I first saw the movie, Lawrence of Arabia, as a little kid growing up in Taiwan. And I have this very distinct memory of it had already been out about 4 or 5 years. It took that long for movies to come to Taiwan. But, of course, I'd never heard of him at that point. But I was instantly fascinated by his story and had never seen the desert before. And then over the years of being a journalist and spending a lot of time in the Middle East, that whole period of history of World War One and the political divisions that came after World War One have a way of constantly coming up. Whenever you're ever having a sort of a political or historical discussion with people, it always goes back to that time. So it was always been in the back of my mind of him as a really fascinating figure, and that period being something I really wanted to explore.
So I have to go back. You grew up in Taiwan?
I grew up in East Asia. My father was an agricultural advisor for the American government. So 5 years in Taiwan and a couple of years in Korea and Indonesia.
And then you went on to become a foreign correspondent.
Right.
Before you were a full-time writer.
Right.
Of books. Had you worked in this part of the world?
Most of the research, most of the journalism I've done is long-form narrative, 8,000-10,000 word stories.
A lot often for the New York Times Magazine.
The New York Times Magazine has been the primary one. And almost always on foreign and usually covering conflict. So if you cover conflict in the modern age, you're going to go to the Middle East. So I have been in a lot of the places that Lawrence was running through and where a lot of the stuff happened in World War One.
So when you have a figure again who's as famous as T.E. Lawrence, how do you approach it in a fresh way? I mean, what is there new to say for those of us who think of him as Peter O'Toole and Prince Faisal as, you know, Alec Guinness?
Right. There's been scores of biographies done on Lawrence, and I always was setting out that I wanted to just cover the war period. I had like this little epiphany in going back to the central riddle of Lawrence, which was essentially, how did he do it? How did a 28-year-old Oxford scholar who, without a single day of military training, how did he go off to Arabia and become a leader, a battlefield leader of the Arab rebels? And it occurred to me that the reason he was able to do it was because no one was paying much attention. This came in the midst of World War One. The whole Middle Eastern theater of World War One was very much a sideshow, as Lawrence himself described it. So if this young kind of eccentric guy could go off and cause problems for the Turkish enemy, great, go do it. And so he was able to operate with very little adult supervision. And then from that, it occurred to me that if that was true about Lawrence, because certainly the British were the biggest imperial players in the region, then it must have been true about the other warring factions. And so once I figured out how to write about Lawrence, I started looking around and found this other small cast of characters, in most cases with very similar bios to Lawrence. I mean, they tended to be in their late 20s, early 30s. And operating with very little control.
And this is really, in a way, a group biography of four different men. Tell us about these other less well-known men.
Right. Lawrence being the primary one, because I think that's fitting because as I said, the British were the principal players. They waged the war and they created the peace afterwards. So it makes sense that Lawrence would be the primary character. There's three other principal characters. Aaron Aronson was a Jewish settler in Palestine, an agronomist and a Zionist, and he set up a spy ring among Jewish settlers in Palestine, working for the British. And what made him such a powerful figure was he was really the first Zionist to come along to show how practically Palestine could support a huge influx of Jewish settlers. Prior to that, it was kind of a religious or a political notion, but he was the one who kind of showed exactly, because of his background in agronomy.
And he was working for the British as a spy.
He was working for the British as a
spy.
And
who was he spying on primarily in that area?
The Turks, the Turkish army that were in control of Syria, and Palestine at that time was a part of Syria. The only American intelligence officer in the Middle East during World War I, a guy named William Yale, who was a fallen aristocrat.
The Standard Oil.
Standard Oil. He had gone off to the Middle East for Standard Oil of New York, was in Turkish-held Syria until 1917, based out of Jerusalem, because the Americans hadn't come into the war. When the Americans did come into the war in 1917, he briefly came back to the States. The State Department, there was no CIA or OSS at that time. They sent him back to the region as their special agent in the region.
And what was his mission there?
Basically to gather information to see what the British operations were doing and to report back to the State Department of what was going on. As he was seeing the political ramifications building towards the end of the war, tried very hard to get the American government to take an interest.
Qualifications for
none.
This kind of...
Yeah, he had absolutely none. that's the wonderful thing about all these guys. I mean, none of them had qualifications.
They were all these amateur spies.
Amateurs, yeah. They're amateurs they're people placed in this spot where all these major things are happening, and really by their force of personality. And I think one thing that all four of them really shared was they all were brilliant, incredibly ambitious, but really ruthless. They all had a real talent for treachery, both within their own organizations. I mean, Lawrence was a master bureaucratic infighter. You know, you would never want to, you know, if you're a tenure track college professor, you'd never want to lock horns with this guy.
David Lean didn't show this part.
No. It was a time when, if you were at the right place in the right time, and you had that force of personality, you could really affect dramatic events.
And did they succeed in these missions? Were they obviously we know what became of T. Lawrence and what
right.
he was able to accomplish.
To a degree, Aronson. There's an amazing thing with Aronson where he had set up the spy ring in Palestine. It took him over a year to get the British, who were in Egypt, to pay attention, to actually make connection with him and with his spy ring. The first follower he sent over to meet with the British intelligence in Cairo, it was actually his younger brother. He met with one of the heads of military intelligence and said, look, we have this spy ring in Palestine. We want to work for you. And the guy just didn't trust him because he didn't really want anything in return. And so he ordered him out of Egypt, and he put him on a ship to New York. So it took another 4 or 5 months before the next connection could be made. I mean, Yale really tried, the American, he really tried to get the Americans to involve themselves and to try to thwart the secret deal that the British and the French had worked out for the division of the Middle East. But it really, at the end, it all kind of came to naught. At the Paris Peace Conference, the Americans basically just turned their back on the Middle East. I was going to mention that the fourth character is a German named Kurt Prüfer, who had a very similar bio to Lawrence. He was an Oriental scholar, had worked at the German embassy in Cairo for a number of years. And when the war started up, he became this counterintelligence officer and a saboteur, operated throughout the Middle East during the war, and then survived the war, and then ended up later becoming a high-ranking Nazi diplomat when Hitler came to power. Hmm. The one ace in the hole that the Germans had over the British and the French in World War I was that Germany was not a colonizing power of any Muslim Arab country. So they had this idea of uniting the Arabs in this kind of Islamic jihad against the colonial powers. So it was kind of the first sort of anti-West Islamic jihad was sort of spawned during World War I.
For those of us who have seen the movie more than once, and in fact, I actually went and after you and I met a few months ago, went back and watched the movie again, even the second DVD. What does the movie get wrong?
It's funny. I deliberately never watched the movie the whole time, the 5 years I was working on the book, but I just watched it again a few weeks ago. I actually think the thing that's amazing about that movie is that it gets right far more than it gets wrong. It really gets the quirky nature of Lawrence. Everybody who knew Lawrence talked about that there's a kind of a funny streak of effeminacy about him. He had this high girlish laugh and a kind of a funny way of running.
How did he run?
Kind of awkwardly and to the side. Very much like Peter, if you could remember how Peter, just this awkward, lopey run. It looks like he's about to tip over at any moment. It got how he kind of went mad out there. I think Lawrence really did kind of flirt with insanity towards the end of the war. I mean, he was going into battle, ordering no prisoners to be taken, and then executing prisoners when they were taken. I mean, it gets wrong what any movie that trying to cover a historical period gets wrong, of really simplifying down the politics, obviously, of it, which is deadly in a movie. A lot of composite characters in the movie that were actually, you know, say three or four different men joined to one. But I was actually very impressed in that I actually think that the movie gets something about the essence of Lawrence that, better than almost any book I've seen. And again, it's that kind of Shakespearean tragic figure that he became at the end of the war. And I think it's because the two screenwriters of the movie were both war veterans. And I think that to really get Lawrence and what a tortured, haunted figure he became, you sort of have to know war to really get at him. Well, the one thing they got wrong, Peter O'Toole actually looks an awful lot like Lawrence.
No, I would say Lawrence was better looking than
him. Oh, really?
we can debate that.
But Peter O'Toole is 6'3" and Lawrence was 5'4", so there's always
there's a
foot
difference. Thanks so much, Scott, for coming in. The book, again, is Lawrence in Arabia, War, Deceit, Imperial Folly, and the Making of the Modern Middle East. And it is reviewed in this week's issue by Alex von Tunzelman. Thanks again.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is Ava Gardner, The Secret Conversations by Peter Evans and Ava Gardner. That's Ava Gardner, The Secret Conversations, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
Brenda Wineapple is here. Her new book is Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848 to 1877. Thanks so much for coming in, Brenda.
Thank you for having me.
This is an interesting period that you're looking at because so often, you know, it's either the Civil War or the lead up to the Civil War and the war or the war and the aftermath. But you really took a very broad range here. Why did you decide to use these years as your...
Well, traditionally, those years are cut-off years because 1848 is the end of the Mexican War, and historians often like to periodize in terms of war. So it ends the war, but it's more complicated than that, as I'll say in a minute. And 1877 is considered the end of Reconstruction with the beginning of the Hayes administration, Rutherford B. Hayes. So it's a very kind of traditional 30-year span. But 1848 is a really interesting year, in addition to the end of the Mexican War, because it signals the beginning of a women's movement, the California Gold Rush. So there's a lot of things that are happening in 1848. And then the 30-year period is interesting, and you're right, it's almost like three separate periods, and each could be its own book. And there are many books on each one.
And you divided your book into the three.
Yeah,
three.
It actually happened that way. It was almost a happy accident. I wasn't counting chapters, and then when I went back to make the sections, I saw, oh my God, they fall into a regular pattern of 8 and 8 and 8. What I was interested in and what fascinated me is that often the war, the Civil War, is thought of by itself. But actually, the period before and after it is at part of that same war. It's not fought on the battlefield, but it's certainly fought in Congress, among people, and definitely in the South and the West in the years after Appomattox. So it was an interesting way to put these things together. Daunting, of course.
You're not approaching this as a military history.
Oh,
however.
No. No. I would feel very much out of my element. I mean, there are the requisite battles that you feel that you really have, you owe it to the reader. But I wanted to come at everything, including the battles and the military situations from a very different angle, one that one wouldn't expect because much about this period is known. So if I'm going to, for example, talk about Bull Run, I want to talk about the journalists who covered it so we know how we got that information. So it's really more cultural and political history.
You've written several literary biographies.
My last book, White Heat, which is a story of the friendship between Emily Dickinson, the recluse, and Thomas Wentworth Higginson, really brought me in a different direction because Higginson was a noted abolitionist and he was the leader of the first federally authorized regiment of black troops in South Carolina. So that really talked about the historical circumstances in which poetry was set. So that was cultural and political history from my point of view anyway.
And the title of this book comes from Dickinson.
It does, indeed. It comes from a wonderful poem, The Heart is Capital of the Mind. And it really speaks to the way we are individuals and one nation, and also the idea of ecstasy, which is not only happiness and liberation, but a kind of fervor and frenzy that you see in the period, too, a sense that there are no limits at all, and a great deal of hope and optimism and some tragedy as well.
As you mentioned earlier, this is obviously a period that's been much
mined.
So you mentioned, you know, covering the way that journalists approached and covered Bull Run. In what other ways did you make this new or different from what's already out there about this period?
Well, for example, one of my first decisions was to begin the book after the prologue, to begin the book with an expedition to Cuba. One doesn't often think of the run-up to the Civil War in terms of the Caribbean, in terms of Cuba, but here we have what were called filibusters, a group of men financed to a certain extent secretly by the government going in to take over, or they hoped to take over, another nation to make it a slave state. So that, to me, encapsulated some of the tensions and the horrors that would become the war, but from a different and unexpected position. Then I talk a great deal about the women's movement, about spiritualists, all of these various kinds of groups that come together in the period before the war. And as I said, for the war itself, I wanted to take different angles on what we expect. So instead of the assassination of Lincoln, which of course I cover, I want to take it from the point of view or talk about the conspiracy trial of alleged assassins, and at the same time, right after it, the trial of a so-called war criminal, the man who ran Anderson prison, and bring those together. So I was trying to bring different points of view, ones you wouldn't expect, so that you don't know where you're going in the next chapter, even though it makes, I hope, sense.
Let's go to talk about the women's movement, because that's not, even though that is the same time period, we often think of it as sort of the same Civil War, you know, occurring at the time of the Civil War. So
right.
Let's tell me about how you approached that.
A lot of early women's right activists became very involved in the anti-slavery and then the abolition movement, and they put themselves second, as ladies do, when the war came, because they collaborated in the war effort, and they worked very hard toward the Emancipation Proclamation, toward the 13th Amendment. When it came time time, though, to pass amendments ensuring the right to vote, women were segregated. They were left out of that particular franchise. And there was quite a big argument about who should get the vote, whether it should...
We could only give it to one.
Exactly. Exactly. So it was very interesting. And I've said kind of off the cuff, it's almost as if that particular controversy was revisited when Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were running in 2008 for the primary, because there were people who pitted them against one another in terms of, you know, race versus gender. And it was the same kind of pitting one group against one another that you found in the 1860s. And it really, it's a very difficult, complicated situation.
Did people see at the time the obvious link between the women's suffrage movement and civil rights?
Absolutely, they saw it. And many men who were very sympathetic to the women's movement said that this is what they said. It was, this is the Negro's hour. And Elizabeth Cady Stanton said, it's everybody's hour. It's the nation's hour. But a lot of women, too, joined with the groups that were pushing the franchise for black men, because they felt, pragmatically speaking, as you said, only one group could go, and to put two together would lose the franchise for everyone. So it was a very complicated, as I said, issue where the women were really left behind, and it's really up to history to decide whether that was fair or not, whether those who argued only one could go first were right or not. It's very hard to know, really, but women did not get the vote until 1920, so there is something very strange going on there, certainly.
Was there an expectation that they had made this sacrifice and that therefore sort of there would be a recognition to follow?
Absolutely, there was that expectation among a group of them. Again, not all women were united in this particular way. There were women who felt, no, they don't want the vote particularly, or they felt that the black men should go first. Of course, the people who really get left out are black women.
And during the period of Reconstruction and then Jim Crow, and there was obviously such a backlash against African-Americans, was there a similar backlash against women?
There wasn't a backlash because basically the women lost.
Yeah.
The backlash against the enfranchisement of blacks and the freeing of black men and the freeing of the slaves changed a whole culture in the South. So that backlash was severe, and it would actually grow in intensity during the period after the one after I cover, because during before 1877, there were actually tremendous gains made in the black community. And because of those gains, to a certain extent, those gains created the backlash, which was really terrible and as tragic in many ways as the war itself.
So let's talk about the post-war period and Reconstruction. What did you choose to focus on during that period?
Well, one of the things that I came to this book wondering was, well, how was I taught? And that's generally how I start a book, is what are the notions or assumptions that have been drilled into me and that I'm not comfortable with. And one of the ones that I wasn't comfortable with was the way I'd been taught about, you know, what I'd been taught about Reconstruction. For example, that Thaddeus Stevens, the radical Republican, was a devil. That was the take on Reconstruction, that the radical Republicans had ruined it for everyone and that moderates would have done much better. And because of the vilification of certain people, I wanted to go back and actually look at the record and see what happened and see to what extent it really had failed and to see what extent it really was a success and to see what extent these people were doing the best that they really could. The other question I had when I started doing Reconstruction or thinking about it was, wait a minute, what happened to the rest of the country? While the terrible depredations and the violence and the rise of the Klan was all happening in the South, what else was going on? And I read lots of newspapers and read the Congressional Globe. And what was interesting to me at this time was that there even though the war was over, there were other wars, undeclared wars, going on in the West, and the West was being cleared of four white settlers, and a lot of the members of the military who'd fought in the war were now in the pushing West. And in fact, even the photographers who had given us pictures of the war, we see them like the Metropolitan Museum now, they too had gone West. So there was a whole westward movement in terms of the beauty of the place, but in terms of also a kind of greed to get that land for white settlers, and that meant there was money. Exactly. And there was money there, certainly. There was money in the Dakota Hills, so Custer pressed to the Dakota Hills. At the same time, we have money being taken out of, not literally, but metaphorically, of the South, and a kind of change in disposition. So I wanted to know to what extent these two seemingly unrelated events were related. So I went in with those kinds of questions to see what the connections were.
Well, this book is Ecstatic Nation, Confidence, Crisis, and Compromise, 1848 to 1877. Brenda Wineapple, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you. It's my pleasure, Pamela.
Leonard Marcus, the great children's book historian, is here. He is the author of a new book called Randolph Caldecott, The Man Who Could Not Stop Drawing. Leonard, thank you so much for coming in.
It's great to be here, Pamela.
So you wrote an essay for the Book Review this week about Caldecott, who we know of as, of course, the man who gave name to the Caldecott Medal. But we don't know as much about his work. Who was Randolph Caldecott?
He was an English illustrator from the later half of the 19th century. His father wanted him to be a bank clerk, but he always doodled on the bank forms and headed for London from the English Midlands to make his way as a freelance illustrator. He did this at a time when picture books, books for children in general, were very statically designed. There'd be a picture in one place and a block of type somewhere else. And he had a much more dynamic approach to illustration and design. And when he had his chance, he came up with essentially the art form that we think of as the picture book today.
What did he do that was innovative?
Well, he wanted to make characters look like they were moving across the page. He had a sense of energy and a very un-Victorian sense of freedom and simplicity and getting away from the clutteredness that we associate with as much with Victorian home furnishings as we do with Victorian art. And he had been looking at Japanese prints. He probably had been looking at the stop-action photographs of Edward Muybridge. He was very much a man of the generation that invented the motion picture.
And then Thomas Edison, right? That you think that he may have seen the early films of...
Well, he was born within a year of Edison. Whether he saw films or not, he certainly saw those arcade novelties where things would spin around and people and animals would appear to be moving. He wanted to do the same for books for children, children being very animated creatures themselves.
Are his books, are they in print today?
They're not as widely available as they were as recently as 20 or 30 years ago. American librarians saw them as a pinnacle of picture book making, and so they made a point of having them available in children's rooms all over America. They were published in the U.S. during his lifetime in the 1870s and 80s. After the medal was named after him, all of the librarians who give the medal wanted to know who the medal was named for. In recent times, as we all know, publishing has become a lot more commercial, and older books tend to fall by the wayside. But interestingly, a few years ago, when a Japanese publishing company, which had gotten started right after World War II, wanted to celebrate its contribution to the picture book in Japan, they looked back to the source of all picture books, Randolph Caldecott, and reissued all of his books in a gorgeous facsimile edition, which was later picked up by the Huntington Library in the U.S. So in that way, his books are still available.
So many children's books that people buy today are still, you know, the classics, at least of the 60s and of that period. Think of, obviously, Sendak. Is there something about his books that doesn't feel contemporary or that is dated or different from what people are looking for today in a picture book?
Well, I would say that some are more accessible today than others, like his book, The House That Jack Built, which is based on a nursery rhyme, which is still pretty well known, is really lively. Mm-hmm. And the cat he drew, for example, looks like it really is ready to pounce, and you feel the energy of it, and as well as the beauty of the way he drew it. Others of his books were set in an earlier time for him, in the rural England that preceded the Industrial Revolution, which was the period when he was growing up. I mean, it was a curious blend because his subjects were often old-fashioned and nostalgic, remembering a so-called simpler time. But his approach to design and illustration was almost revolutionary. It's more that he sort of created the structure that people like Marie Sendak and Robert McCloskey and many others, David Wiesner, have all built on.
Right. And Sendak was a big Caldecott fan.
Oh, yeah. He saw him as the absolute master. And when he collected the essays that he had written about children's books and illustration, he called it Caldecott and Company.
The Caldecott Medal is celebrating its 75th anniversary today. When that was begun, the Newbery was already in existence. Mm-hmm. And why did they decide to create a medal, an award for illustrated books, and how did they come to name it after Caldecott?
Mm-hmm. Both medals were created by the public librarians, who saw themselves as the great shapers of children's books and the guardians of children as far as their lives as readers was concerned. The Newbery Medal, which started in the 1920s, was meant to be a kind of Pulitzer Prize for children's literature. And it had an immediate effect. Book buying parents were directed toward those books, and more writers of the highest order were encouraged to write for children, which was a big statement because a lot of people thought that was a second-class thing to be doing.
How dare they?
Yeah, exactly. So in the 30s, the decade that followed the beginnings of the Newbery Medal, you had a lot of illustrators who were out of work because of the Depression, and they saw children's book illustration as a potential opportunity, also to reach an audience, which artists often want to do. And then there were a lot of artists coming from Europe who were fleeing political oppression in the beginnings or the foreshadowings of World War II. So there was this great pool of talent in New York, and many of those people made picture books. And so the librarian said, well, let's do the same for these people that we did for the writers.
And were they also illustrating in The New Yorker and other magazines during that period?
That's
the
right.
Same way we see today.
Exactly.
And how did they decide to name it after Caldecott?
Well, it's very interesting because both Caldecott and Newbery were Englishmen. And the librarians had a keen sense of tradition. So they wanted to make a nod to the past, the tradition that they wanted to build on. But at the same time, they wanted to encourage American artists and writers to work for American children. So they made it a stipulation that you had to be an American resident or citizen to win either medal.
And your new book, Randolph Caldecott, The Man Who Could Not Stop Drawing, obviously showcases a lot of the illustration that Caldecott himself did. Do you have a favorite Caldecott illustration?
There are both line drawings and drawings in color. He loved to make fun of himself, and there are some self-portraits, which he did at the top of the letters that he wrote to his friends, where it looks as if he's been touched by an electrical wire. His hair is flying out, and he looks totally crazed and bewildered by life. And it was that sense of irreverence and humanity that he was able to communicate in his books for children that I think, despite whatever's old-fashioned about them, really make them wonderful even today.
That was Leonard Marcus, who not only wrote this new biography of Caldecott, Randolph Caldecott, The Man Who Could Not Stop Drawing, but also is the curator of a great exhibit at the New York Public Library, still on, The ABC of It, Why Children's Books Matter. Thanks so much, Leonard, for coming in.
Well, thank you.
Greg Coles joins us with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
On the hardcover fiction list this week, Robert Galbraith, really J.K. Rowling, is still new at number one with The Cuckoo's Calling, followed in short order by Dan Brown's Inferno and Khaled Hosseini's And the Mountains Echoed. So some predictable books at the top of the list there. There are just two new books on the hardcover fiction list this week. New at number 7, the thriller writer C.J. Box has a new book called The Highway. C.J. stands for Charles James. He's famous for the Joe Pickett series, but The Highway is not part of that series. It's actually the second in a new series that he's started, the Cody Hoyt series. They're kind of wilderness thrillers, and Cody Hoyt is a former investigator. In this case, looking
for... Is that a genre, wilderness thrillers?
Yeah, going all the way back to Deliverance, right?
Right.
And then new at number 12 on the list this week is the novel Death Angel by Linda Fairstein. That's also part of a series. It's the 15th book in her Alex Cooper series. Alex, short for Alexandra, a Manhattan assistant district attorney. And in this one, she's looking into serial killer.
All right. What about nonfiction?
Well, nonfiction, the top of the list is still Reza Aslan, Zealot, holding on strong at number 1. Followed by Mark Leibovich, This Town, at number 2, and Sheryl Sandberg's still rolling in it.
Leaning in, but falling back a tiny bit.
Right. She drops from number 2 to number 3 this week with Lean In. The only new book on the list this week is a book that came out in England last year. It's called A Street Cat Named Bob. It's by a guy named James Bowen. He spent almost a decade as a homeless heroin addict on the streets of London. He came to England via Australia, hoped to make it as, you know, kind of a Kurt Cobain rock star type. He got the heroin part of that down, but not the rock star part of it. And he ended up living on the streets and believes he may well have died there, except that he was adopted by a stray cat that he named Bob. And he tried to get rid of Bob, and Bob just kept following him around. And he started caring for Bob, and in doing that, stopped wallowing quite so much in his own troubles. And he and Bob really kind of turned their lives around together.
So despite my original impression, not a children's book.
No, not a children's book. In England, I should say, Bob has become like the rock star that James Bowen never did. Bob the Cat is as famous as Marley the Dog was here. And people throng bookstores for him. Bowen has taught him a number of tricks. He'll give high fives. He signs books with, you know, with paw stamps and ink and that kind of thing. And he has just written a follow-up book called The World According to Bob that has not come out in America yet.
But Pete the Cat for the older street busker population.
There you go.
All right. Well, we have more cat books to look forward to then. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.